Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice Veazey, Honorable Justices. Justice Jacobs, first time I've had the pleasure of appearing before you ever, I guess, since you were in Chancery Court. I know you're supposed to start with your strongest point, but I'm going to start with my weakest and abandon argument four and apologize to the court. That was not a well-written argument, and it was there was some confusion on my part as to a witness, so I apologize for taking up the court's time with that argument. I talked to the prosecutor, and we're going to abandon it at this point in time. Attempting to divine the interests of the court ahead of time is always difficult, but on the assumption that the issue that I think is the most meritorious issue here is the same one that the court is focused on, I'd like to focus my attention on the issue regarding the conflict of interest as it relates to the testimony of the witness Othello pre-Doe. Obviously, as the court knows, I represented Mr. Flowers at trial. I got involved in the case after Mr. Peterson, a conflict attorney, had previously withdrawn. It became known, as the court sees, the day before the trial was scheduled to begin the first time, that a witness who I had previously represented, Othello pre-Doe, was going to be testifying on behalf of the state. As the court knows, Mr. Flowers was convicted of first-degree murder in a case that essentially was presented through five witnesses, three of whom all the testimony came in pursuant to 3507, and two of the witnesses backed off considerably at trial from the identification testimony that they had previously given in the case. So Mr. Pre-Doe was a particularly important witness because he was an eyewitness present at the time, allegedly of the incident, who had come forward approximately 4 years after the crime, which occurred on August 1st of 1998, and at a time when Mr. Pre-Doe himself was facing serious charges involving mandatory jail time and involving very lengthy jail time. He was a very important witness for the reasons which I articulated in my my argument, and the state moved to disqualify me prior to the first trial date. We learned of the existence of Mr. Pre-Doe after the jury actually was selected but not sworn. So we briefed it before the late Judge Alford dealing with Rule 1.9, and Judge Alford ruled correctly, I believe, that the matter on which I had previously represented Mr. Pre-Doe several years before was not the same or substantially related to the case involving Mr. Flowers and the testimony that Mr. Pre-Doe was going to give.
Now, when that ruling was made, did the judge really address the fact that the prior representation would be important to impeaching Mr. Pre-Doe?
Yes, that was discussed in the office conference after the issue first came up, and it was a consideration that was important to me as well, because as the rule states, I am not permitted to continue in the representation if I'm going to use any information that I learned in a confidential way from Mr. Pre-Doe. I will represent, notwithstanding one of the shots that the state made in their brief, that all the information that was utilized in connection with the cross-examination of Mr. Pre-Doe came from public records. I went back, I reviewed the prothonotary's files, I looked at the affidavits of probable cause in the prothonotary's files, and to the extent that any of the prior information was used in the cross-examination of Mr. Pre-Doe, it came from the public records. The judge did mention that initially, there was a discussion about whether or not confidential information would be used, which is the second prong of 1.9, and that was considered, and I can represent to the court that I did not use any confidential information in my cross-examination of Mr. Pre-Doe, nor did I need to, since all of the information that I needed to impeach him came from public records and from cases which were then pending in the courts.
And what precautions were taken at trial, knowing you were going to impeach him about a matter in which you'd represented him, to make sure that wasn't going to come before the jury?
Some talk, as you saw in the notes from the office conference, where Judge Alford, late Judge Alford, indicated that it would not be necessary for the jury to learn that I ever represented Mr. Pre-Doe. The only efforts I made were to make sure that my questions were as precise and leading as possible so that I would avoid any possibility that he would respond to any of my questions with the answer that he actually, in an unresponsive fashion, gave. I can't speak for the state. Immediately after the information came out, Judge Alford asked the state whether or not they had instructed their witness or talked to their witness, and Mr. Rambo, I think at the time, indicated that they had not, and it was not their responsibility to do so. I had no access to Mr. Prideaux in advance. I suppose in retrospect and in hindsight, before he testified, I probably should have asked the judge to instruct him not to make any comments about that, but I did not do that. The trial judge did not, on her own, say anything to the witness, and I don't know what the prosecutor is going to say, but I suspect he wasn't even interviewed before he testified, given the factual circumstances and the way that he testified on the witness stand, because by that time he had become a reluctant witness to the state. So anyway, my approach in cross-examining him was that I felt that I could fully and effectively cross-examine him in the manner which I've already articulated in terms of using information that is of public record and consistent with the provisions of Rule 1.9. I think that in reviewing the transcript, if you review the transcript, Mr. Prideaux's answer was completely non-responsive to the question that I placed to him on cross-examination. I don't think there's any question about that, nor can it be argued, although the state tries to argue that I opened the door on that. The questions that I asked were very precise, very narrow. I know how to cross-examine, and there was no expectation that he was going to blurt that information out at the time that he did. Our position was that, and again, when I was thinking about this last night, whether it was my fault, whether it was the prosecutor's fault, and first of all, I don't think it was my fault, but even if it was, the issue here is the effect that it had on Mr. Flowers' rights to a defense with a credible defense attorney. I know, and many of you know from doing trial work, that the single most important thing in a jury trial is to gain the trust of the jury and to be credible in front of the jury. If the jury stops believing me, then they're not going to believe in my cause and they're not going to believe in my client. I think that I mentioned in the brief, and it was supported by the record below, that a couple of the jurors, when the witness blurted this out, laughed when they heard it. As I tried to argue in my brief, I think the jury at that point in time, not being familiar with the provisions of Rule 1.9 and the nuances of professional ethics, could well have concluded that I was untrustworthy because I was all over this witness in terms of cross-examining him, trying to make him look like a liar and someone who wasn't worthy of belief. And then it comes out and the jury finds out that I had once represented him, certainly was an attack, not an attack, but I think had a significant effect on my credibility. We had filed a motion for new trial, and in filing the motion for new trial, the way I read the court's opinion, that the court more or less concedes that what happened was improper, but applying Hughes and Weddington and that analysis found that the error didn't vitiate the fairness of the trial. The court, in doing that, mistakenly believed that the court had instructed the jury at that time, which the court did not instruct the jury. So that one prong of the Hughes analysis was not met. There was no instruction. I certainly didn't ask for one, but the court was mistaken when they did it. So I'd like to kind of go back to, there's case law in this area, and also stress what I tried to stress in the brief, and that was that I had a strategy in this case from the start, and the strategy in the case was Mr. Flowers was not going to testify. He had a prior criminal record. At least one of the crimes was going to be admissible for impeachment purposes, the robbery conviction, trafficking, maybe not, but the strategy was to keep him off the witness stand. Even though this court has ruled otherwise, the judge prior to trial allowed a question on the impact of that on the jury. We severed a case before severed one of the charges, which would have suggested prior record to the jury. And the whole thrust of my case was to, as in many cases, was to attack the prosecution's case without putting my client on the stand or without putting our credibility necessarily an issue in that respect. In a case like that, I think there's some support for this in the case law that was cited in the brief, in a case like that, the credibility of counsel is most important because the decision on whether a defendant will testify or not testify is sufficiently problematic potentially for jurors that anything that relates to that can diminish that decision as well. So I would argue that this effect on the defendant's right to, and I use the word effective counsel without trying to suggest ineffective assistance of counsel, but effective counsel and being able to be believable is doubly problematic in a situation where the defendant himself does not take the witness stand, and the jury could well then be questioning my judgment or our reasons for not putting him on the witness stand.
Well, how do you characterize Judge Alford's ruling that there was no conflict or that there was a conflict that your client would be permitted to waive?
I characterize her ruling as saying that there was no conflict. I have not even discussed the fact that my client waived, that's on the record, that he waived any potential conflict. But I think under Rule 1, I'm supposed to say I think, under Rule 1.9, I would submit to the court that there is no conflict of interest under these circumstances. Now, this could have wide-ranging implications for the practice of a law at the lower court level.
But we have seen a lot of situations where people assert a conflict affirmatively based on prior representation of a witness.
Correct. Absolutely. And I know back when I was in the public defender's office, it would be standard. If you represented a witness previously, you would get out of the case. Now,
it's standard today, and since we've gone down this path and I'm no longer interfering with your focused argument,
okay.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Yes.
Isn't it common in Superior Court to automatically allow the public defender's office out of a case and bring in contract counsel under circumstances either similar to or even less compelling than the ones in this case?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That has always been, I mean, I've been in the trial courts for 28 years now. If a defense lawyer asserts a conflict of interest by saying that he previously represented a witness, for the most part, that has ended the inquiry, and the conflict would be established, and the person would get out of the case. But when you look at Rule 1.9 in its current status, and as Judge Alford, I believe, correctly ruled, unless I have some affiliation with that client, for example, there are certain clients I've had who I like, and I would never keep a case under those kind of circumstances because I would feel there was a personal reason why I couldn't do my job properly.
Does that suggest that the focus is on whether counsel is comfortable with the conflict or not?
I think that's probably a better way to look at it because there might be a subjective reason for there to be a conflict. For example, if Othello Preto was someone who I liked and had gotten along with or even remembered, to be honest with you, I barely even remembered the fella, that's a lot different, I think, than if the witness in the case is a friend of a friend.
It also raises implications if you're dealing with an office as large as the public defender's office. If you weren't the public defender who had personally represented that witness before, why would your entire office be conflicted?
Well, I think under Rule 1.9, they're clearly not. And that's even a more compelling reason for there not to be declared a conflict of interest.
I think Justice Steele's referencing 110, which is the imputation of conflict.
Right. That would be our position, but my concern here is the way I looked in front of the jury and the way it reflected on Mr. Flowers. That's my concern. I think I used a different word in the lower courts, but I felt almost like the jury looked at me as if I was a prostitute, where I would serve one interest at one time and then serve another interest at another time, again without understanding the nuances of professional ethical rules and the fleeting or ephemeral relationships that you have with clients in terms of developing associations with them. Mr. Flowers was entitled to not have that be an issue in the case, and we immediately moved for mistrial.
Now, you moved for a mistrial, but you didn't then when that was denied, asked for any type of curative instruction. Is that correct?
I did not ask for an instruction, correct, because that's always the tough decision that you have to make, whether you want to bring the attention. The jury was taken out. Argument was had. They came back in. It's a tactical decision whether you want to draw their attention to it again or whether you want to let it go.
Did the jury, I should know this from reading the record, I apologize, but did you make the motion, just say, I move for a mistrial in front of the jury, or just ask the jury to be, the court to excuse the
jury? We went to sidebar and asked the jury to be
excused. So the jury didn't hear a motion for a mistrial?
No, they did not. The transcript specifically, he says it, I start to say, answer my, and then I stop, and then I approach sidebar.
What's surprising in this record is that the circumstance that evolved was grounds for a mistrial. We normally see that dealt with in advance. You know, if you have a second trial after an appeal, everybody knows you don't refer to the first trial in everyone's instructing their witnesses. It would seem after the ruling was made where you could stay in the kid, mm-hmm. if knowledge that you'd represented this witness before would be grounds for a mistrial, why wasn't that discussed as part of the ruling?
Well, the only time the judge discussed it, and the judge didn't say anything in her written opinion, the only time the judge discussed it was in the office conference after the state made the information available to the court at that time. After that, Mr. Prideaux got on the stand. I didn't know, and I'm not necessarily trying to assess blame here because I could have asked the judge for a ruling if I was wanted to be 100% sure. I don't know whether the state, well, I know they didn't because I know Mr. Rambo said on the record we never instructed them and we didn't feel it was our responsibility to instruct them, which I think it probably was. But again, I don't know whether he, after he gave his statement, Ms. Kelsey's not here to answer this question, whether he was ever interviewed again. Or whether he was just brought up, put on the stand, and off we went. Because really, the state really didn't care what he said at trial. They just wanted to get his taped statement in, because the taped statement was what was damaging, and they had to develop the foundational elements of 3507 to get this evidence in. And once they got that done, I think that's all they really cared about from Mr. Prideaux. They didn't care what he said at the trial itself. So, I think, coupled a little bit with the other argument that I made where the jury became aware of the fact that Mr. Flowers had previously been incarcerated I would use the word reckless in that respect as it relates to the other argument that I made where I actually went to the prosecutor and I said to him, please don't ask that question in that way because this is how the witness is going to answer, and the prosecutor nevertheless went ahead and asked the question. And the jury finds out then that Mr. Flowers had been in jail previously.
I don't want to take up all of your philosophy, but help the court understand how this is going to evolve in future cases. You asserted in this case there was no conflict, and the court, and then the trial went forward. If the motion had been granted, then the defendant would be saying, I've been denied the right to counsel of my choice, and then the court could have said, well, I think this counsel has a conflict. If you want to waive it, you can waive it on the record, but then whatever happens is going to be something that you're taking responsibility for. Here, we've got a hybrid situation where that never happened, and yet we're trying to solve the problem after the fact.
Retrospectively, I understand that, and I think that's probably the fault of all the participants in the system in this particular case, that this was not addressed in advance and that the witness was not advised not to mention it. If the witness doesn't mention it, it's never a problem. And if, when you look towards the future, when this situation comes up, well, this case was kind of, it's not the posture you're going to see it, because I was privately retained, and where this comes up more often, I think, is through the public defender's office.
No, but that's why I asked it, because if Judge Alford had ruled there was a conflict, then the client would have had an opportunity to waive it in order to keep the privately retained counsel.
And then I think that we wouldn't have this issue if that had occurred, because then it could truly be said by the state that Mr. Flowers and the defense brought this upon himself by waiving a conflict of interest that otherwise existed.
Well, then you have the situation where you then follow up, and I agree with you, it's not an issue about blame, but you follow up and the court instructs outside the presence of the jury, the witness not to mention anything about the earlier representation, and yet during trial in the presence of the jury, the witness mentions it anyway. Then what do you do?
Well, then I don't know how you do that, deal with that, other than, I don't know.
Well, there are a couple of cases like the Bailey case where a mistrial was declared sua sponte by the trial judge when the witness had been told that directly and then mentioned the prior trial anyway.
Correct. And I don't know that there's anything we can do under those circumstances except to say that then Rule 1.9 should not be Rule 1.9. We should have a different rule because clearly under Rule 1.9, if you assume that I did not use any confidential information, which I'm representing I didn't, for what it's worth, if you assume that, then this clearly was not the same or a substantially related matter. So therefore, under the terms of the rule, there is no conflict of interest. I think in the future you can attempt to solve the problem by instructing all the parties involved, but this court decided the case of Ashley versus State where the demonstrator person just walks in the courtroom and screams something out. I mean, you can't always totally control everything.
Mr. Maurer, you're into your rebuttal time.
I am.
Do you want to save it or do you want to use it?
There's 3 minutes. I'll save it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Williams?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. I'll try to focus on the...
You're making your work hard today. This is your second hour.
You are, and I apologize for raising my voice too much. I didn't take an antihistamine this morning because I didn't want to be even slower moving and more fuzzier thinking than usual, and I probably should have, so I apologize to the court for that.
No problem.
Hopefully I won't lose my voice. turning to the third issue, and I certainly don't mean to impute any wrongdoing to Mr. Maurer here. I think he's an excellent attorney, and probably the problem in this particular case and the reason it arose is because he's such a good attorney and he's so good at cross-examining hostile witnesses. And the difficulty here was that he was alerted to the problem from the get-go. The state actually sought to disqualify him in this particular case. And my experience has been that when defense counsel represent witnesses, especially witnesses who are going to say very damaging things here, this was an eyewitness to a homicide, that defense counsel see that as at least a potential conflict of interest and seek to withdraw from the case. That's apparently what happened for at
now,
least...
Should Judge Alford have ruled the other way? I mean, that was the state's position at trial. And then what we're going to be trying to sort out here is, you know, whether there was a conflict or not.
Well, that's the tough question. It would have made everything a whole lot easier had the trial judge agreed with the state, because I think what the state foresaw as a potential problem did in fact occur here. So I guess the answer is yes, it would have been easier.
Mr. Wade,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Mr. Wade, I was just looking at this transcript about whether the state was obliged to instruct this witness not to blurt this out. And it's a little unclear to me whether they had that obligation. Mr. Rambo said they didn't have that obligation. And there was some suggestion in this record at page 857 that the state did have that obligation.
Can you tell me
what the answer to that is?
Well, I don't know that the state had any obligation, and I think Mr. Rambo was correct that there was no indication that the state had, in fact, instructed Mr. Perdow.
Here's my reference. It's in this block of 121, the upper left-hand quadrant of this page, A57. Mr. Rambo, we are exactly at the juncture the state warned us about a month ago. The court, but the state was supposed to instruct the witness, Mr. Rambo. Never were we requested to instruct anyone. Moreover, we understand that he's testified to today compared to that tape. And then the court says, I'm sorry. So I guess the state did not undertake, as part of the previous matter before Judge Alford on the Rule 1.9, to instruct this witness.
No, I don't believe the state did. I think that's what occurred. And apparently there's some difference in the recollection between the trial judge and the one of the trial prosecutors as to whether or not the state was ever instructed to do that. And the judge seems to indicate that initially there was some indication that the state should have done that, and then Mr. Rambo says that they were not requested, and then the judge says, I'm sorry. Now, exactly how much you make of I'm sorry, I'm not sure. If the judge means I'm mistaken, that's one thing. If the judge just says, well, it's not an important matter, I guess, at this point, given what's happened, then we'll move on.
Would have been a good thing if that had happened. Justice Steele has a question. Sorry,
interrupted. No problem. How important to Judge Alford does the record suggest, when she made her initial ruling about the conflict, that the state do go forward and instruct the witness, not to mention the earlier representation? The reason I ask that question, if I were sitting as Judge Alford and asked to make the ruling, I would have thought it would have been important to my ruling to make it clear that someone, the state or me as the trial judge, would instruct that witness not to put the case in the posture of being retried because something might be blurted out by the witness that would cause a motion for a mistrial.
Well, I don't know if it's the state's responsibility, the trial judges, or both. I mean, presumably.
Well, my question is there anything in the record that suggests that it was part and parcel of her ruling, an understanding that someone would instruct that witness to be careful about the circumstances surrounding the earlier representation by Mr. Maurer?
I don't think it was. Now, what would be reasonably inferred, I don't know, but I don't think, you know, the state certainly wasn't instructed that you have to instruct the witness. The trial judge certainly didn't instruct the witness. And then what happened was things started out okay on the cross-examination. The difficulty was when Mr. Maurer started zeroing in on the prior offenses and then started asking about weapons and violence and things like that, that Mr. Perdow was obviously becoming defensive on the stand.
What I'm trying to get a handle on is it had to be clear to the trial judge in her mind that there was certain risk involved with denying the state's motion and allowing Mr. Maurer to continue as this defendant's counsel when a witness against his client was a former client. Why wouldn't the trial judge have taken the step to assure that the risk was minimized, and why wouldn't it be obvious that a way in which to minimize it would be to have the party who's calling that witness instruct that witness not to blurt out anything that would compromise her ruling?
Well, I think that's certainly one way to handle it, and an appropriate way. And perhaps even more appropriate way is for the trial judge herself to have instructed the witness not to do that. As can be seen from Mr. Perdow's direct testimony, wasn't all that helpful a state witness. What was helpful was that we were able to introduce the prior, more incriminatory statement.
All that aside, now, Mr. Maurer's claim is that it so tainted his continued representation of the defendant that both he and his client's strategy was destroyed. It raised the issue of his credibility and the need to reverse his strategy and call the defendant to the stand, and if he did that, would put his then client, the defendant's credibility in issue. What's the state's response to that?
Well, I think that really goes to the heart of what's this all about. And what happened here was a mistrial motion made by defense counsel after Mr. Perdow's unresponsive remark, and I agree it was an unresponsive remark, was made. Normally, the mistrial is reserved when there aren't any practical or reasonable alternatives, and the trial judge is normally accorded deference to decide whether a mistrial has to be declared or not. And in this particular instance, it's important to look at Mr. Perdow's testimony in conjunction with the testimony of the other individuals. He admittedly was a very incriminatory witness, but there were four other eyewitnesses who were equally incriminatory to some degree. Some people said that Mr. Flowers was there and had a gun. Other people said, no, Mr. Flowers was the shooter who shot Mr. Smiley. Even if you took Mr. Perdow's testimony out here, there's still more than sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Flowers here. Mr. Flowers doesn't take the stand. There's no other explanation offered to the jury. Mr. Flowers flees the jurisdiction for approximately 18 months after the homicide and is extradited back from North Carolina. Defense counsel had a very difficult case to defend here, regardless of what Mr. Prideaux did or didn't say on the witness stand. There was substantial other evidence here. And given that volume of other evidence, I think the trial judge's decision not to declare a mistrial was appropriate here. It was certainly unfortunate that all of this happened, but the state tried to head it off at the beginning. Prior counsel, at least the second counsel, had moved to withdraw Mr. Peterson from the representation of Mr. Flowers when it became obvious to Mr. Peterson that one of the potential state witnesses was a former client. The normal procedure, I think, has already been discussed here, that the public defender's office routinely files motions to withdraw from representation when one of the prosecution witnesses is a former client in the particular case, and that's to avoid even getting involved into the difficulties of Rule 1.9a here. I'm not sure.
In your brief, there's a suggestion that Mr. Flowers either waived the problem or assumed the risk of the problem. Is there any record support for that?
Well, I think he assumed the risk of it when he said that he waived the conflict. Now, I'm not sure that it was Mr. Flowers' conflict to waive. It's Mr. Prideaux's conflict. He's the former client, and if there had been a meaningful waiver that anyone was trying to hang their hat on here, it should have been from Mr. Prideaux, and that
well,
I don't
but
think
really,
occurred.
But really, both clients had a conflict to consider. Mr. Prideaux had to be concerned about prior competences, but Mr. Flowers had to be concerned about whether his representation would be compromised in this case by the prior representation. And is there any indication that Mr. Flowers said, I understand my representation may be compromised, but I want to go forward anyway?
Well, I don't know if he says all that. I think the representation made by defense counsel was that he had discussed the situation with his present client, Mr. Flowers, and that Mr. Flowers had waived the conflict. Now, exactly how much he was told or what he was told by defense counsel, I don't know.
Well, wouldn't it be fair to assume in light of what happened that the nature of the representation to the client was similar to the representation that was made to the court, namely that I can ask all the questions I intend to ask using only publicly available information and I will not betray any client confidences and therefore I don't have to be excluded, and that likewise he would have told his client, well, listen, I'm going to cross-examine this guy and I'm going to do a really thorough job of it and I'll never have to get into anything that's a problem, so it'll all be fine.
Well, I think that's probably exactly what was said, and I think that's why the matter went forward and why the trial judge allowed it to go forward, but I think the difficulty is that...
But that is really where we need to be concerned about the implications of this case in the long run, because we have the situation where the public defender's office routinely enters a disqualification in the present case based on representation of the witness or someone in a prior case. And what was Judge Alpert's ruling here? That there was no conflict with the witness, or that there was no conflict with the defendant, or that there was no conflict with the witness and acknowledged there was a conflict for the defendant, but the defendant had waived that conflict?
Well, I'm not sure if the trial judge answered all of those questions. It's a fairly short ruling. I believe it's attached as Exhibit
well,
A.
Isn't it fair to say, Mr. Williams, we know the answers to all the questions Justice Holland asked except the one that he's been repeating, and that is, does the record support the defendant acknowledging the conflict and waiving it, or just counsel's representation in that respect?
Well, I think the record is that counsel made the representation. I don't think there's any statement from Mr.
It's Flatt. Fair to say Judge Alford thought she had taken care of any problem with the witness by the representation that it was all public information, et cetera, as Justice Berger has already articulated.
Yes, I think that's true. I think, you know, the judge was confident that the thing could go forward, and unfortunately, as sometimes happens, witnesses surprise people on the stand, and that's what happened in this particular case. Nonetheless,
is it fair to say that that your position on this issue is, number one, that the trial court did not err in denying the mistrial because there were three other witnesses that gave equally incriminatory testimony. And secondly, that if there was an error, the error was harmless for precisely the same reason.
Yes, I think that's true as to both of your questions. There were four other incriminatory witnesses who said that.
So the existence of that incriminatory testimony by the three or four other witnesses does double duty in this case.
Yes, it's cumulative evidence at that point. And it was obvious that, you know, some of these witnesses were very reluctant. Three of the incriminatory witnesses the state presented had to be brought from prison and were not particularly cooperative on the stand, that their prior tape statements were what were more damaging to the accused in this particular case. So I think here we've gotten into sort of a tight situation. What ultimately ought to be the best answer, I'm not really sure. I know the easiest way to have avoided all of this was for the trial judge to have simply granted the state's disqualification motion, but that didn't happen. So now I'm in the position of trying to prop up the trial judge's ruling, but where we had asked that it go the other way.
Well, that's genuinely understandable, isn't it, for at least two reasons. A case is set for trial. It's hard to get on the calendar and go to trial. No trial judge wants to delay any person's cause. And secondly, why would anyone want to keep Gene Meyer out of a case, an experienced criminal defense counsel?
Oh, I think that's
when
exactly
there's an alternative.
I think that's exactly it. And that was the risk everybody took going in. And unfortunately here, the boat almost made it to the harbor, but it just ran aground a little before it docked. And that's the difficulty. But then the question is, okay, that happened. It shouldn't have happened, but it did. Now, what is the alternative? Should the mistrial have been granted? And the state's position is no, that it was not necessary for the trial judge to have granted a mistrial in this particular circumstance, given all of the other evidence in the case here. The other matter that's been alluded to on oral argument this afternoon concerns the statement, and again, it's a very brief statement. This statement of Mr. Perdoe's is very brief. It's just a one little sentence thing. Is a brief statement by the defendant's sister, Ms. Dawson, about when she was asked about when her brother, or how long her brother had lived in her home prior to August 1st, when this fatal shooting occurred. And she answered when he came home from, I don't remember when that was, I don't remember the date, when he came home from jail. Now, at that point, defense counsel, I think they moved for a mistrial at that particular point. There was also a subsequent motion for a new trial after trial. And the argument was that the jail reference was certainly improper here. The trial judge found that the reference, and this is the ruling on the new trial motion by the trial judge, and that's Exhibit A to the state's answer brief at page 6. She said that the reference was brief and that the witness did not reveal why the defendant was in prison or for how long. And there was a prompt excision of this particular material here. I think it was a situation again where there was a mistrial motion, and the trial judge again found properly that it was not so prejudicial that a curative instruction would not be adequate here. And I think that was done, and that was all that was required.
Are you comfortable with counsel's representation here today that he alerted the prosecutor to the possibility that a question asked along the lines that the prosecutor asked it might evoke that response, and that it would be prejudicial, and that the prosecutor knew about that in advance and nevertheless asked the question anyway?
Well, I think there was certainly some discussion, and I think what you have again is an unresponsive answer from a witness in this particular case. Here it's just the prosecutor as opposed to defense counsel getting an unexpected
answer. Isn't it fundamentally
answer?
More important than that, if it's correct that defense counsel alerted the prosecutor to the possibility that that would happen in advance, and then the prosecutor didn't caution the state's witness not to respond in that way?
Well, I think what the prosecutor was trying to do, and perhaps she wasn't as artful as she should have been, all she was asking was for a time period. How long was it?
No, I understand that the response was not common sense
solicited by the question.
Mm-hmm.
But that is that really the point? If, in fact, it's correct that Mr. Maurer said to the prosecutor, you're going to be in danger of getting this response, whatever the phraseology might have been, be careful and don't ask a question that will get her, that will cause her to say that her brother or whatever had been incarcerated. Did the prosecutor then say to the witness, whatever you do in response to any of my questions, don't make the statement that he was in jail?
I don't know that there's any indication in the record that ever occurred. I think what the prosecutor did in this case was try to answer
the
question. Well, I don't know. It's a problem when you get unresponsive questions. You know, you try to structure the questions as best you can. What the whole reason to get into
it is trouble is that the prosecutor, being put on notice that there would be a problem, didn't take action to avoid the problem.
Well, I think she did take action.
What was it?
She took action by asking a specific question. How long? Give me a time period. That's all that question envisions. Now, what can happen after that is, well, you've opened Pandora's box, I suppose, with these witnesses. This was the defendant's sister who was testifying.
Well, you make the argument that somehow the defendant assumed the risk of trouble by asking a question of a witness that the defense counsel had formerly represented. Why didn't the prosecution here assume the risk of a mistrial by ignoring Mr. Maurer's suggestion that they cautioned the witness not to say that the defendant had been incarcerated? And they went ahead, did not caution the witness, and asked a question that evoked that response, whether it was unresponsive or not. Did the state not assume the risk of a mistrial?
Well,
we conclude that it was prejudicial.
Well, the state may have assumed the risk, but the state did what it could. It asked a specific question. Should the state have cautioned the witness? Probably that would have been helpful. Ultimately, would it have made a difference? I don't know.
That may be the ultimate question, but I'm having some trouble with the state did what it could when it was alerted to the potential problem.
Well, I think the prosecutor at least tried to formulate a question that if a response was given to that question, there would not have been a difficulty. The only reason really even to get into all this was the fact that there was flight here after the shooting, and the state was wanting to introduce evidence of flight here as a consciousness of guilt by Mr. Flowers. That is, he couldn't be found for approximately 18 months. He had been living at his sister's house, and immediately after the shooting on August 1, he disappears and goes to North Carolina. All the state was trying to do in this question was just to indicate how long he had been at his sister's house, that apparently was his place of residence or his normal place of residence.
Mr. Williams, in his brief and also today, Mr. Maurer makes the point, the gist of his argument is that the unresponsive answer to the question which revealed that the defendant had been incarcerated effectively deprived the defense of their strategy, which was to keep the defendant off the witness stand. Your response to that argument in your brief, or I should say the state's response to the argument in its brief, is that the jury instruction cured any prejudice. But that response doesn't really come to grips with the gist of the argument that the defense was deprived of its strategy. What is the response?
Well, I think the response is that, and that's the response this court has made in other cases in different contexts, is that if the trial judge gives a prompt curative instruction and the offending material is promptly excised, that's sufficient. And the basis or the rationale for that, the philosophical underpinning, is that we assume that juries follow instructions, that they do what the trial judge tells them. And if they did that, then they would discount that. Now, he wasn't convicted of a first-degree murder because he had been in jail for some other unspecified reason before. He was convicted of first-degree murder because five eyewitnesses said he was the one who shot Mr. Smiley in his automobile because he blew his horn at some people who were in the street and blocking the roadway. That's what this case comes down to in this particular instance. Here, I don't think the trial judge abused her discretion in handling either of these matters, that mistrials weren't appropriate. Ultimately, I think defense counsel's credibility was not really compromised with the jury, in the sense that jurors are well aware that attorneys represent various clients, and that you're not going to necessarily identify the attorney with the client he represents, however bad or good or meritorious the client may be. That the attorney is doing a particular job, and that's the role of the attorney. I don't think defense counsel's effectiveness was undermined or so eroded in this particular case that it reasonably affected the result of trial. If there are any additional questions, I'll try to answer those.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you.
Mr. Mallon?
Thanks for the opportunity. I've got 3 minutes. I just want to talk about the evidence just a little bit so that we can be fair. And first of all, there were three witnesses who testified primarily by 3507 who were kind of street-type people. And two of the witnesses that testified against the defendant who had previously identified in the trial, when they testified at trial, backed off of their identifications, and both of them admitted. One said he was clearly mistaken. The other one said that he probably was mistaken about the identification. The other witnesses were impeached. So in terms of harmless error, to stand up and say that the case was overwhelming against the defendant, it was not. It was a tough case. But the jury deliberated, as I mentioned, for 10 hours over 3 days, so that they did not come to a quick and speedy resolution of this. As far as the last argument that Mr. Williams made, Mr. Rambo knew exactly how to, it was not Ms. Kelsey, it was Mr. Rambo, how to frame those questions, because after, if you look in the transcript, after the cat was let out of the bag, he knew exactly how to ask leading questions, which is basically what I told him to do, was lead the witness, and he did it, and he got the answers that he wanted without any hesitation whatsoever from the witness. Last, we don't know why this person was convicted, and for the prosecutor to stand up here and say he was convicted for this reason, and that the fact that he doesn't have any prior record, that he had a prior record and that became known to the jury, didn't have anything to do with it, we don't know that. That's anecdotal. I think the cases suggest, I think anybody who's done trial work knows, that once that jury finds out that your client has a previous conviction, you're in trouble. The whole dynamic of the case shifts because they now know that this defendant has a prior criminal record. So that is very, very important, I would submit, and not to be lightly pushed aside. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maurer. The court will take the case under advisement and will stand adjourned.
Walking in the room, and they were just saying, please rise, and that's it. The court will take it under advisement.